G'day, this is Shane Hastie for the InfoQ Culture Podcast. I'm at Agile 2017 and talking with Sean Dunn and Chris Edwards. Sean, Chris, thank you. Welcome. Really appreciate your taking the time to come and talk to us. Now, obviously, we know each other, but I suspect that most of our audience haven't met the two of you. So would you mind introducing yourselves?
I'm Chris Edwards. I'm a software development manager at Solium. We're based out of Calgary, kind of frequent Agile conference attendee and speaker.
And I'm Sean Dunn, and I'm a principal software engineer at IHS Market in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And one thing of note specifically to Chris and I that might be relevant to our talk is that we're both licensed professional engineers in the province of Alberta, Canada, which relates to some of the topics that we were talking about in our talk today.
So this concept of a licensed professional engineer, this is quite an important characteristic and not something that you see much in software engineering.
It's somewhat unique to the jurisdiction where, I mean, in Canada, like doctors, like lawyers, the term engineer is actually a regulated profession. It's a regulated title. So you cannot call yourself an engineer. You cannot practice engineering by law unless you are licensed with one of the regulatory bodies. And there's some good reasons for that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. And software does kind of fits in a niche part of the engineering world that we realize doesn't necessarily translate to other places.
Well, Philip Christian talks about the need for some sort of oversight when you're in the space of building software that kills.
And I think that's the obvious examples of where being a software developer, where we have to be considering the public's interest. We were talking today about a number of situations where the intersection between software development and the public interest is widening, where it may not be directly obvious that the actions we take necessarily are going to result in someone dying, but could impact the overall, you know, health or well-being of our society.
So the talk that you gave here was about professionalism and ethics in software. Do tell us more.
Right. And as Chris was saying, is this intersection of the public interest. And our governing body is the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of Alberta, who by law governs our profession. And they actually have a great code of conduct that they put a great amount of effort into that we are legally obliged to follow. And so they lay out kind of all the conditions that we need to comply with to be able to do our jobs. And some of them are acting in an ethical manner with honesty, integrity. And perhaps one distinguishing characteristic, I think, of a profession, and we cite this a lot, is we must hold paramount the public interest. And that means above our own interests, and that also means above the interests of our employer, because the public has a special trust and confidence in our ability to execute, because if we don't, you put them at risk. So by law, we actually have to put the interests of the public first. And as professional engineers, we might be the only person in our company who actually has that legal responsibility. That puts us potentially in conflict situations where there's two different competing interests that we are now have to make some very difficult decisions about.
One of the things that I'm aware of is the concept of, in many countries, they run trust surveys. Many years ago, information technology, or I recall it as data processing back then, we were, as a profession, perceived to be high trust. We were up there with doctors, with engineers, with teachers. I know these are anecdotal self-selected surveys from things like Reader's Digest, but in a recent one that I saw, software engineers were slightly just above lawyers, and there were software developers, lawyers, and sex workers were the bottom three. Politicians were down there as well. So what's happened to our industry that's caused this?
It's interesting you bring this up, because when our engineering profession was inducted, it was due to largely motivated by this decrease in the trust that the public had. So we had prominent disasters that had occurred, like the famous one in Canada being the collapse of the Quebec Bridge that killed a number of workers. And as a profession, the ability to the public to extend to us the invitation to do our jobs essentially was waning. the creation of the profession was to actually govern the ethics and standards. We don't really have anything like this in software. If I behave in a way that will, you know, dishonor the profession or act undignified, I really have no consequences other than potentially losing my job, versus as an engineer, I could actually be up for disciplinary action.
And I would say in some organizations, you're going to get a bonus.
Yeah, exactly. There's some fairly prominent incidents going on right now at Google, for instance. An individual got fired yesterday for behaving in a very undignified way, and I think that's probably a polite way of putting it. So we've got actions at Volkswagen, where a software change was made to cheat the emissions test. At some point, a software developer had to write that line of code and make that decision. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they were asked to by a manager. We don't actually know at this point, but it's our profession as a whole that we're being
judged in the eyes of the public.
Yeah, we're being judged in the eyes of the public for those actions.
You mentioned before, a lot of the classic examples are life or death, death, life and limb, implications to the public interest. Mm-hmm. I mean, people could die or get seriously injured. And these are very clear and obvious with things like chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering. It was more nebulous when it came to software. I mean, clearly there were examples of aerospace and nuclear mm-hmm. medical and some tragic incidences because of software that came out of that. But not all software fits into those categories. So do we have the same level of responsibility? Do you need the same kind of governance over that part of the profession where, you know, you're building a point of sale application or a line of business application? One of the points in our talk was that this intersection is growing fast, where it's not necessarily just life or limb anymore. We have a responsibility to the public interest that is beyond life and limb, that potentially we can have impact on like the socioeconomic institutions to a degree that we've never had before. And so now what ethical, moral, professional responsibilities do we have?
Training algorithms that destroy the value of a company.
Another one was cases of machine learning algorithms being used to analyze the voting population. There's potential for gerrymandering to be and voter suppression to be used on an extreme individual level. This has implications to our democratic institutions.
Examples of things we would deem not desirable in our society in terms of, you know, racial bias and other types of biases, if we're not careful, we can actually inadvertently develop systems, machine learning systems and algorithms that perpetuate or even amplify these already existing negative characteristics in our society. And we create this, you know, positive feedback cycle with negative consequences. And, you know, the scale on which software is deployed on a global scale, the cumulative effect of all these things over a period of time could be quite significant and quite dangerous. So whose responsibility it is to think about that? And unlike, you know, a bridge or something will have a very acute, catastrophic, obvious failure that everybody will see, these are going to be more chronic and cumulative and potentially more nefarious. So all the more reasons that we have a professional responsibility to think about them now.
Not obvious that they're happening. That one example of there's a research done where they found a machine learning algorithm was used to filter out CVs, resumes. Mm-hmm. That was being fed with data that had an existing bias present by the people who were creating the data set. Mm-hmm. They found that when they fed through the exact same CV with different names, one with a Northern European name and one with an African American name, the CVs with the European name were 50% more likely to be accepted. Unless someone ran that experiment, you would have no idea that that bias would be present in that system. So what role does the software professional have in the writing of that program to be aware of the consequences of how that is going to be used?
How do we convey this in our industry? How do we get people, make software developers aware of this, for one? And then how do we train them? How do we teach them this stuff?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't think we have the answers. I mean, we could certainly point to the way engineering's regulated in Canada that's been effective for the disciplines of engineering as a whole. But, I mean, these types of questions, I know I certainly did get trained to be aware of, you know, well, how machine learning could have impact society. I think that it probably should be included in training somehow. But then how do you apply that to all the various jurisdictions, you know, in the world where we've got people writing software? Does it need to be regulated? Or is there professional bodies that should do that? It's a very good question.
This is really the motivation behind our talk. Mm-hmm. Was we we don't profess to have the answers to these kinds of greater questions, but I think do have some awareness that these issues exist. And because of our background in engineering as a profession, we're cognizant of some of the greater implications. And we wanted to start the conversation, create some awareness. And I think that's where we start anyway.
You mentioned the code of conduct and rules of ethics and so forth. What are the types of things that are in there? You said duty to society. What does that mean to me?
Right. So the first one is engineers, professional engineers shall hold paramount being a key word, the public interest and regard for the environment. So above all else, we have to keep that in mind when we're doing our job, and that has acknowledged that at some point may be in conflict with the interests of our employer. And we have to resist those pressures and remember that first and foremost, it's the public interest.
I think what's interesting about this is that even when we were in school, we were being prepared for these types of decisions. From the first year of engineering, we got told case studies like the Quebec Bridge collapse. In fourth year engineering, we take a professionalism and ethics class. When we graduate, we participate in what's known as the Iron Ring Ceremony, which is a fairly solemn experience that instills a sense of weight of responsibility. We have to complete a very challenging ethics exam to be able to get a professional designation. The sort of culmination of this experience prepares you for this moment when you've got the pressures of real life situation. Without that preparation, without knowing that one day you might have to make this decision between your personal finances or the interest of your company and the public, would people be ready to say no to something they didn't think was right in those situations?
There's almost a degree of indoctrination or deliberate mental exercise to get to visualize this potential ethical dilemma scenario you might have to appreciate one day, so that you'll have the moral courage in that moment with all the pressures to make the call in the interest of the public good. And it's like practicing towards that, because you can't just hope and rely in that moment that, you know, with all of the pressures that you're going to make the right call. So it takes practice.
The other element we focus on in our talk from the ethical guidelines, the rules of conduct, was to help that a professional must uphold the dignity and honor of the profession. And we talked a bit about that already, but this idea that we have to continue to represent the profession in a good light in the public so that they will continue to trust us to undertake that. And the absolute basic one is that you cannot have a criminal record and be a member of our professional organization. But also we have to do certain amounts of like community service as part of being a professional and continue to act in a dignified way.
Continued education, you know, continued professional development. Yeah, you have to represent it well, because ultimately the public has to trust us. Mm-hmm. And so the perception of us in front of the public, we have a responsibility to uphold and enhance is the term.
What does this mean to me as hobbyist software developer building a new game?
That's a great question. And it's one I don't think we have an answer to, because what we want to discourage is having like elitist profession, and it's not designed to be elitist. We don't want to discourage the, you know, 16-year-old learning coding in their basement from writing an iPhone app, or you're a hobbyist developing a game. That shouldn't be discouraged. And so there's this very real question of, okay, well, where do you draw the line between something that is going to have broad social, you know, implications or implications of public interest and that which is not? And in software, that's very hard to determine. And I think we need to have, as an industry, that conversation about that.
We're definitely not advocating for, say, software development being outlawed unless you're a member of a professional organization. It's just not feasible. However, what steps could we start taking in organizations to instill a sense of responsibility in the profession, to gain more respect in the profession? What elements in an organization discourage dissent and encourage a drive towards, you know, ultimately a lot of organizations, it's all about, it's the number one thing is delivery and can we get the product out the door? Someone standing up and saying, I don't think this is right, in many organizations is going to be either at best, you know, removed any opportunities for promotion and advancement, and at worst exited from the organization. So what incentives does an organization have to essentially employ someone that is either a professional or actually a member of an organization? Maybe a company like Volkswagen, there'd be benefits to them, say, to the market, to now change their reputation. We're only going to employ software professionals. That would be one option. It's an open discussion that I think both Sean and I are having, and we definitely were having with the participants of our session today.
What were some of the tough questions that came up from that session today?
I mean, the participants were fantastic. I mean, it was a great setting that was very interactive. So they had some great, great case studies of, you know, ethical dilemmas on their own from their own experiences that they brought up. And so I think there was some great examples or questions that we might have already talked about a little bit of, like, okay, so where do you draw the line between something that has a big social impact and the hobbyist developer? How does an organization actually do something about this? You increase professionalism in an organization.
One example I remember someone brought up was they were working in the medical field. I can't remember exactly the type of product they were making, but they actually outsource certain aspects of the code. So they're building a product that's potentially going to be used in impacting, you know, someone's life, yet the people writing it are in another country. So do I have an obligation to be aware of what they're writing? This overall conversation led to discussions around, do we even, like, so if I'm a software tester, is my obligation to test the specific test cases that I've been given? Or do I still have an obligation to understand the eventual outcome of the product I'm building beyond just the completion of the test cases? And I think this fits right into this whole concept of agile, where we want to get away from throwing things over the fence to total ownership of the team, of the outcomes of what we're building. And this, I believe, is a core tenet of professionalism, that we cannot detach our actions from the outcomes. Ignorance is not an excuse.
And it has a tie-in with culture and psychological safety, in the sense that you don't arrive at a bad ethical, like a major bad ethical decision just, you know, by accident. It's the culmination of having a culture usually that has valued certain behaviors, and now people are used to behaving in that way. So the example of the Shuttle Challenger disaster and the Rogers report, one of the findings was NASA had developed a can-do attitude. It can do anything, and it was viewed very negatively if you said that something wasn't possible or you couldn't do it. And this happens all the time, as Chris said, in organizations where, you know, we don't want to be the ones that say we can't meet a commitment or something's not going to be shipped on time. And you get in the habit of doing that, and you've actually discouraged the ability for someone to have the integrity at that critical moment when it is important to stand up and say no.
The other, I think, going back to tough questions we received, one was, well, not everyone has the financial capability to risk losing their job to say no. So if I'm in a situation where, you know, I really think what's happening is wrong, I'm just maybe going to go along with it because maybe I can't find another job, or maybe it's taken me a long time to find this job and I don't have an easy answer to that question.
I mean, I think we're fortunate in our jurisdiction that actually having a regulatory self-governing body is an advantage, because one, you've got a greater consequence, not only just risking your job. If you don't do the right ethical thing, you're actually risking all future opportunities, employment, if you undergo, you know, disciplinary procedures and you lose your license. I think there's also a sense of encouragement or boldness to know that you have an independent body that's backing you in your ethical behavior. You know, as if I was someone in that position who was worried about my job, I would be more likely to stand up if I knew that I was being backed by something.
So, and let's go back to that Volkswagen case, because we talked about this in the talk. Somebody brought up, well, we don't know what the individuals in that case did. They may have raised the red flag. They may have raised it up the chain. But because they didn't have anywhere else to go, what other options do they have other than to quit out of protest?
In many countries, many jurisdictions, there are professional associations. I'm from New Zealand. We have used to be the New Zealand Computer Society. They have rebranded, and I confess I've forgotten the new acronym. But they do have a code of ethics and a code of conduct. But the worst they can do is slap you on the wrist and say, you shouldn't do that.
Do they have the ability to eject you from the organization?
Yeah.
Okay. Or are there, I guess, consequences to your career beyond that?
No.
And I think
that's the thing.
Ultimately, there has to be, you know, in Alberta, I will not be able to practice engineering anymore. That's an actual consequence.
But could you practice software development, not software engineering?
I could. And software development is not a regulated aspect. So I employ many software developers who are not engineers. And this is maybe the tricky part with our profession. Unless there is sort of a broad acceptance that we should, in our industry, that we should only employ software professionals that are a member of this body, then perhaps there are no ultimate consequences to unethical behavior.
Does it allow us to keep people out who shouldn't be kept out?
So that comes to this concept of elitism.
Is a governing organization, professional body, does that create a sense of a monopoly on something? And it's not a monopoly in the sense that it is possible to join. There's criteria which are really designed, and they're very clear public criteria that I've actually been tested or whether they follow all the human rights regulations too, but to ensure that if you can pass an ethical exam, which is difficult, but it's difficult for a reason, if you can show the appropriate technical knowledge, if you can improve the ability to execute, to apply the technical knowledge under supervision, and then if you've got kind of all these things met, there's no reason not to, to accept you, and the applications are reviewed that way. So it's not meant to exclude people, but it's also meant to ensure that there is a standard, because without that standard, then we're not going to maintain the trust of the public.
What advice to the InfoQ audience? We are technical influencers. What's your advice for them?
The first advice I would give is to look at your own environment. If you're a software developer, think about opportunities in your job where you could be speaking up for things that don't quite seem quite right. If you're a manager or an executive, think about what is valued and rewarded in your organization. Do you tend to reward people who focus just on completing work? And will you stifle people who will speak up against things? Or will you reward people who speak their mind? Are you creating the environment where essentially you are going to reward professional behavior or discourage it? I think that's, we really have to start this within our organizations at a closer level.
Even within your own team, if you're looking at your own team level, I mean, do you have established, when should we say no? What is our standard and definition of integrity and professional behavior? We talk about, all these other definitions of done and definition. Like, do we have our own standard for what this looks like for us? So that, I mean, we're a self-governing organization, part of a self-governing organization. We hold each other accountable as peers. Do we know what that looks like even on our own teams, to hold each other accountable for ethical behavior, for professional behavior?
Right. It doesn't have to be at a whole corporate level. Even like within an agile team, you could be having a conversation. What does professionalism mean? What does that look like? What decisions are we making that will fall into that sort of area of ethical and professional behavior?
And as a manager or someone in a leadership position looking to develop professionals, junior professionals in the industry who are going to grow up, I would say look at making sure that they go through the mental exercise, that they know that it's actually going to be their responsibility one day to say the unpopular thing, to develop the sense of moral courage in people, and actually use that as a necessary part of developing people.
Sean, Chris, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing where this conversation goes.
So do we.
Thanks.